Yeah, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk in. So I'm Oliver Brinding, I'm from Nottingham. My supervisor is Ivan Fisenko, and the topic that we're interested in is actually Adele's on schemes, which are very interesting because they provide some natural compactification in some number theory related things, but I will not talk about that. I'll try to give a general view on intersection theory. And typically a talk about that will probably start with something like the Zeus theory, which is a good reason not to do it. Instead, I'll try to start with some very, natural or intuitive picture where you can actually draw pictures and say, so and so many intersections. So I'll call the first thing that we shall do very naive. So what is a very naive intersection theory? Well, let's take two curves, why not? And say, okay, they meet here, they meet here, so they intersect in 2 points. And I will move them around a little bit. Now they don't intersect at all. Maybe we'll move them around like that as well. Well, that's supposed to just be moved around. And now we'd say this one. Of course, we are old enough that we would probably not try to do intersection theory that way. That's a little bit very naive. I mean, it's a sort of set theoretic intersection. And what we see what is bad about it is that it's not sort of invariant under little changes. No? We'd like to have some theory if we just change a little bit, that things remain somehow constant. So for example, an analogy would be to consider the fundamental theory of algebra, a polynomial of degree n has exactly n solutions, and so that does not change if I change the polynomial around, but it only works if I consider zeros with a multiplicity. If I take something like x minus 3 squared, and so that only adds two zeros if I count with some sort of multiplicity. So we could guess that if we consider some notion of multiplicity, we get an isotheory here as well. And that is indeed the case. So this is the first interesting thing. So this would be real manifold version. I don't think this is an official word, right? So better don't keep it in mind. What the trick is, I'll just repeat this picture to give all these curves an orientation. So we could say this curve goes this way, so we have it three times. This maybe goes this way, with the same orientation. And then we'd say, okay, so now both of these curves have an orientation. So in particular, if we consider a tangent space at just some point, we have oriented spaces. And in case of a transversal intersection, we can just take the tangent space of a surrounding manifold at this point, and by the definition of transversal, that just means that the tangent spaces of these two curves form a direct sum decomposition of the tangent space of the surrounding space at this point. We can just concatenate these two positively oriented bases that we get here, and the definition would kind of be, if the intersection is transversal and this concatenated basis is also positively oriented, we give it a multiplicity plus one. If it's not, we give it multiplicity minus one. So in this case, if we sum up, we get multiplicity zero. Well, here obviously, and here we don't really know because it's not transversal and we shall not care about it. But in good hope that this theory will have some sort of invariant property, we'd of course expect this to be zero as well. So this is kind of one thing one can do. Okay, consider multiplicities. At least in the transversal case, just give it plus or minus one, depending on how the orientations look like. Okay, so just to give an example of how that behaves in a more interesting scenario, let's consider a torus. So this is all real manifold width, so it's not an elliptic curve or anything. And we take some curves on that. Some, for example, such a closed curve and another curve which somewhere, does something else here. And, well, how does it intersect? Well, whatever orientation we pick, it doesn't matter. We always get a plus one and a minus one, or the other way around, so it sums up to zero. So, okay, that's not so interesting. Well, you can come up with many other examples like that, something like that, and whatever. It will always add up to zero. So, and the only interesting things that we get is when we consider a curve which goes around, well, one would probably have guessed. And a curve like that. Well, this is kind of a lot of examples in one picture now, but I mean, you see what's happening, right? So we don't care about these, and we get that one transversal intersection here. And depending on the orientation which we choose, which we may freely pick, this would be plus one or minus one, but at least it's not zero. And now if you play around with this a little bit more, you see that basically this is the only scenario where you get a non-trivial intersection. But now you may keep in mind that, or you may recall that if you look at the cohomology of a torus, you can, so that would be T2, which you can compute by Knuth because it's just two copies of the sphere. I'll do everything with real coefficients, okay? It's just generated, so if you allow me to use some vague, not so detailed identification with singular homology, you can just say that the cohomology is generated by exactly one curve around here and one curve the other way around. So as we've just seen, that everything which does not come from such a curve is zero in this intersection theory if we use this definition, which is not really a good definition at the moment because I haven't said what we should do if it's not transversal. But, well, we see as the cohomology is generated by these two things, and these apparently are the only ones which produce something non-trivial, we could guess, okay, our intersection theory maybe should factor through cohomology. That would be the idea. And so if we start from this idea that we can just take some closed-oriented submanifolds, consider them in cohomology, and then define an intersection pairing which is supposed to put out these numbers, then we define this on cohomology, we actually can, going this way, you know, like following this direction, we get a construction of a theory which has exactly this property in a very, very nice way. So how can we do this in detail? I've done quite a lot of work. You can do this with singular homology, but because it's more useful later, I'll use the Durham cohomology all the time, and just to tell you how it works to realize a complex oriented submanifold in a cohomology group. Let me just show you how this works. So from now on, X is going to be real oriented. So probably connected. Real manifold and Z oriented closed submanifold. Everything without boundaries or such funny things. Then we can define a function. We give this, we say, codimension P. Then we can integrate any P form on X over Z. Well, we pull it back to Z, so we take any P form, it's called alpha, a P form of the surrounding manifold. We pull it back on Z. Well, so let this be a closed embedding. And integrate it over Z, and it's a top form. So, I mean, so that this form is a form of degree P, which is exactly the. So now, which is exactly. So, I mean, we are exactly in the right degree to be able to integrate. And this gives us a functional on all P forms. Well, so we'll directly realize that it's a functional on the P cohomology. So for any P form on the surrounding manifold. Well, I'll write this more clearly. So for any T form, we get a functional to the reals, which are called Z, which is just defined by associating to alpha this value. So alpha goes to this, which is real. I'll also assume compact, so maybe we don't have to worry about maybe that something gets infinite. Okay, so this is a, well, at first this may seem a little bit weird. Why should we do this? I'll give an example in a second. And now the second ingredient, so at first this is a functional, this is a bit weird, and it's not really an element of cohomology, it's because it's a functional, so it's a dual, but well, what do you do if you start something in the dual? The second ingredient would be quantum radiality, which in this case, because we're compact, we don't really have two weird things to happen here. It just says that a pairing given by two forms of these respective degrees by the integral, that this is non-degenerate. So this is this statement. And using that, we can realize this functional as a form. So I mean, we can realize what this says. It's just that we can realize every functional as integral over the wedge with some form. And if this is a functional on HP, this will be a form which lies in N minus P. This is the reason why it's typically more comfortable to work with the codimension. So using this, we get what we can call a cycle class, which I'll just call Z in H N minus PX, which is defined by the determining condition that for any P form, that for any P form that I pull back on Z, this integral is the same as this. So this holds for all HP. Whoa, okay. So that's a lot of definitions, but well, so this is the kind of thing to keep in mind. So the way to realize a real-oriented submanifold in Durand cohomology is by finding a form which has the property that you can express an integral over this complex, over this, sorry, real submanifold in this way. And, well, so we always, so you get such a form, such a, this construction, such a cycle class, not just if you take Z, you also need to have an orientation, otherwise this integral doesn't make sense. And of course, if you switch the orientation, the cycle class just gets the other sign. Okay. So this is the way how we can start off with some curve, for example, and associate to it an element in cohomology. And because this is an accessible talk, I'll give an example. A very simple one, but you'll immediately see what the idea behind it is. We'll just consider a circle and a point sitting on the top of it. And all I'm asking for is, what is the cycle class of this point? Okay, what do we have to do? Well, first of all, we form this functional, so that would be, because our point has dimension zero, there's a functional on the zero on the zeroth cohomology, so h zero of s one to the reals. And what is this functional doing? Oh, it's integrating, but we're integrating over a point. That just means we're taking the value of the function. Well, sorry. Wrong. So a zero form is just a smooth function. So we're integrating that function over the point. Well, pull back to a point. It's kind of pointless. It's just evaluation of the function at this point. But, well, we are also taking that in cohomology. So we know that we only do this on functions which whose differential is zero, but that just means for a function that the ordinary derivative is zero, which means that the function is constant. So it doesn't matter whether we actually evaluate at the point or at any other point. It's all the same. So this is just equivalent to f is constant, right? So we're actually just considering constant functions and associating their value to it. So this functional is really, really simple. So now all we have to find is, so we're not doing Poincaré duality, but whatever, we don't care about any proof or anything. We just think about this relationship. So here we get the constant value of the function, and now we're just looking for something to wedge with it, which, because we're talking about a function, is just to multiply with it, such that we get the value. And that can be, as we're just multiplying with a constant function, you see there can be anything which has just as total integral 1. So if you allow me to draw such a picture, it could be anything which looks like kind of that, where the total integral is 1. And now you may say, okay, I could just take some other shape, so it's not well-defined, but, as we're only considering it in cohomology, it will be well-defined. This cohomology is one-dimensional, so it's actually isomorphic to the integral on the area under the curve. So just as a general idea, whenever you realize something this way, it's a little bit like just... Well, so if you do it all graphically, it's a little bit just like just following and forming a little bump around it that we'll always do. So why do we do all this? Because that's seems a little bit remote. It seems a little bit complicated in comparison to just doing something as explicit as that. But now we can define. An intersection multiplicity of so let Z and Z be just oriented closed real submanifolds of codimensions PQ, adding up to the dimension of the surrounding space. You talk? Okay. And, if they're codimension P and Q, that means we get representing cycloclasses in cohomology. And, it's a bit unfortunate because now P is the dimension here. I'll call it AV, okay? So this is codimension here. Z in H A and that has H B. And we can just define a multiplicity Z prime by taking the wedge product of these two representing forms. It is not a priori clear that this lies in Z, but it does. Maybe for time limitations, I'll not put it on the board, but I can just say, if you are in the case that these intersect transversally, you can deduce a local formula which shows you that if they intersect transversally, it really just comes down to exactly this thing where you just take oriented bases. So what do we see using such a theory? First of all, everything that we can see from an intersection theoretic point of view lives in cohomology. So in particular, if we consider something which doesn't have very interesting cohomology, nothing interesting will happen from an intersection point of view. For example, if you take a sphere that just has top cohomology and all down there, and nothing in the middle, nothing interesting will happen in the middle. It will all, every such cycloclass will always just be zero. It's not interesting at all. So in particular, you can produce many submanifolds, which are all, whenever you intersect them, always have the property that as long as they intersect transversally, it always sums up to zero. Okay, So another property which may be interesting to note is that the wedge product is graded anti-commutative. So if you turn around the order here of these two factors, depending on the co-dimensions, the sign of the multiplicity changes. The same happens if you change your orientation. So there's quite a lot of choice in this. Okay, so why have I done all this? Why is it so... why all this effort? I mean, we could probably have done this in some simpler means. Well, a very nice thing is now that because we're actually doing algebraic geometry, we probably not like to look at something which is real, right? We want to look at complex manifolds because, you know, geometry is really only geometry if you look at it over the complex numbers. And the great thing of this theory is that we can be really, really lazy because now if we just consider complex manifolds, well, what is a complex manifold? It constitutes itself from charts, from CN charts, where we can identify C with R, and so it becomes a, C is just R plus R, right? So we can also consider it as a real manifold of twice its dimension. So in particular, we can just use the same theory, right? We can just look at the complex manifold and use this theory to count intersections. Okay, so is this any interesting? Well, yes it is. Because although we use exactly the same theory, it behaves quite differently. I'll put it there. So this is the complex manifold version. We do exactly the same. So X now, for compatibility with later things, we'll directly assume a smooth projective variety. This is not really necessary here, but over C. And I'll write XC for the associated, n-dimensional complex manifold, which we may also consider as a 2n-dimensional real manifold. Now, the great thing is, first of all, if we just consider complex submanifolds, they will always, say, of complex codimension P, their real codimension will always be twice that, right? Because of the same reason, just because every complex dimension is twice a real one. But that is interesting because it sets us in exactly the right degrees in cohomology so that our product, only considered on complex submanifolds, is actually commutative always. Because the anti-commutative part only happens for odd degrees. But for if you consider a complex submanifold, it's always has even codimension in the real sense. So this is the first difference. So if you define this only for complex submanifolds, this will be commutative. And the second thing is that complex manifolds always come with a canonical orientation. If you haven't seen that, okay. It's not very hard. It's just based on the fact that you just start with holomorphic coordinates and then, you can see it. So in particular, we don't need any oriented assumptions because they all come with a canonical orientation. And in particular, whenever we have a transversal intersection, because even the orientations of the submanifolds are sorts of canonical, they always concatenate to a positively oriented basis. So in case of transversal intersection, we always get plus one, never minus one. So, which is also quite a change. So in particular, this means if your intersection is purely transversal, so at every single point, it cannot happen, which could in the real case, that you actually have a set theoretic intersection, but you can't see it from this theory because they cancel out when they get a multiplicity. That can't happen in the complex case. I'll not put that on the board because I don't have enough time. And another point, which is of course also very useful in all these theories, is that because it's factors through cohomology by construction, you can always compute these things by replacing them with any object which is equivalent on the level of cohomology. And in particular, when you look at complex manifolds, you're also allowed to replace your object by something which is cohomologically equivalent only as a real manifold. Right? So you don't have to replace it by something which is just a complex structure. Okay, so final words. Now, all this is kind of limited to, well, you need a manifold structure, right? So, but maybe you want to do intersection theory just on a scheme, maybe over FP or some weird field. So, you need something which is independent of all this, topology-like stuff. And because of the time is so low, I'll probably not put on any definition on the blackboard. But basically, what you could do is you generalize the definition of a veil divisor class group. Well, what is a veil divisor class group? Where it's just a direct sum of coefficients for closed, well, integral closed subschemes of codimension 1. And you can just do that in general, right? You just consider formal linear combinations of codimension p integral closed subschemes, and then you just generalize linear equivalence as well, so you get a generalization of the veil divisor class group. And it said that I don't have the time to put down the definition on the board, but it's called the Chow group. So this is kind of the algebraic version. And it is very, very, in comparison to all these theories, which are very geometric by intuition, this construction is kind of rigid, and it just starts out with taking a complex, taking an integral closed subscheme as its objects that make up these groups. Well, but these groups are defined kind of differently. So one question would of course be, how do these groups relate to these theories that we have seen here? And there is a map from these Chow groups. So I'll stay with what I said there, smooth projective over C. The Durham cohomology that we've used here. And, well, so if you have a codimension P closed subscheme, this lands in the 2P cohomology. Yeah, this is just the effect that complex codimension is twice the real codimension. The existence of such a map is not obvious. Obviously, you have to prove that whatever is the generalization of linear equivalence also goes to zero here, which is not totally obvious, so you'll have to do some work here. And the interesting thing you would probably also like to know what image and kernel is, but that's a very subtle point. So whenever you define push forwards and pullbacks for this theory, you have them for this theory, all is compatible. You can define a ring structure here, which is quite painful, but it's also compatible with the ring structure which you have on this, on the associated ring, just using the wedge product. We have seen this here. And so just as a maybe final point, what is kind of nice just by having this map, just by knowing that this map exists, is that you can use these explicit representations in terms of integrals to actually obtain some results about how this map behaves. For example, one nice thing is you can always, if you want to know the volume of some object, you can clearly do that by integrating over the volume form. Okay, so you integrate here over the volume form, and you can express that in terms of the cycle class. So you have to do a little bit of work, of course, but if you know that the generalization of linear of principal divisors goes to zero here, you also know that because your cycle class goes to zero, the corresponding integral must be zero. So for example, one thing you just see by the existence of this map is that whenever you have a rationally trivial, that is what it's called, it's a generalization of principal divisor, that the sums of the volumes of its components must sum up to zero. That's just something new that comes from the existence of this map. And you can also conversely use this to show that an irreducible component here does not lie in the kernel, simply because otherwise you'd not be able to express its clearly non-zero volume here in terms of an integral. Well, I fear I've finished my time. So in case anybody has a question, go ahead. So if we want to do this in an algebraic context, purely one can work with this, but there is a problem when this only behaves quite good when we are in this typical situation, proper over fields, so the compact situation. But in particular, number theory is interesting to consider objects which are not compact. That would, for example, be a fiber surface over Z. In fact, if you unwind the definition of, if you consider the analog here of such a thing, that would be, in terms of Chow groups, that would be Chow P to Chow Q. That's just this pair, and it goes to Chow P plus Q. And, well, to get that into a number, you have to push it down to the, what in the case of proper over a field would just be chow zero of the base field, which is Z, so you get a multiplicity. But if your scheme is over Z, you'll have to use chow zero of Z, which is zero, so you don't get anything interesting out of that. And in the one-dimensional case, there's this beautiful concept of an Adel, which in the case of number fields is kind of the compactification which makes it possible to define such a thing which is non-zero. So that really looks like, if one could have a higher dimensional version of Adels, that this may also produce exactly this compactification that you need to get a good and well-behaved intersection theory, which you don't a priori have using these techniques. So there are some techniques which work, but they typically, you just pair, well, you don't really get a product. For example, on fiber surfaces over Z, you can intersect horizontal and vertical divisors, so you have some restrictions. You can also find that in this picture, if you use something non-compact, and you have to use compactly supported homology. But so, okay, maybe I should not talk too long. But so, there's great hope that the use of Adels may lead to a nice compactification, which makes it available to have such theories in a simulation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.